Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Indeed. Thank you, MOTAT. So, beginning, I suppose, just with a little update.
Yeah, so I thought I'd just update where the coronavirus, not is, but where it will be, maybe in a few days or weeks months. And various epidemiologists around the world are trying to predict when are we going to hit the peak? When are we going to hit the maximum number of cases, and everything starts declining after that?
Mm-hmm.
And there's good news and there's not so good news. So there is a lot of variation in this. I don't think this is by any means an exact science, and it depends what numbers you put in your models and how accurate the data is, which is questionable in this case, I think. And so they're really sort of two extremes. On the lower end, an epidemiologist at the London School of Infectious Medicine predicts that we're pretty much at the peak or very close to the peak, expects about 1 million infections thereabouts total.
Okay.
The virus, we're getting thousands or tens of thousands of new infections every day in China. Wuhan, the city where sort of the epicenter of the epidemic, is really under lockdown, and a few sort of neighboring cities are as well. It's difficult to say that one of the guys who was famous for discovering the SARS virus 20 years ago nearly was involved in this study. And although 70,000 people have been confirmed so far, they think there could be up to 1 million total by the end of this, end of this outbreak. That's the good news.
And in the sense that there's not really any good news.
In the sense that, no. It's
a lower number.
That's the lower end.
In the estimates.
But a lot of researchers find these sort of predictions overly optimistic. And this is based on a few things. A lot of people in Chinese cities started returning to work last week after an extended public holiday period, so there's more chance for transmission. A lot of people have been asymptomatic. In other words, they're not really,
showing any signs that they're
infected yet. And so they're not really counted in estimates of the total population of infected people. And so there's sort of the other factors as well, but the outlook from the earlier study, people think maybe a little bit simplistic, and they are estimating between 550, so up to 2.3 million cases will be diagnosed at the peak. This is their estimate. This is the upper end. 2.3 million cases
a day
will be diagnosed per day.
Whereas the lower estimate was
2,000.
Whoa.
Well, that's what we got at the moment.
Okay, so we're talking a huge
number. So he estimates between 550 and 650 million people across China will be infected. That's roughly 40% of the country's population. And about half of those people, he thinks, will show symptoms. So about 200-ish, 250-ish million people, 300 maybe, of people in China will be infected and show symptoms of that infection.
Wow.
At the peak.
That's quite
And they've considered a lot of things, transmission potential, which is this basic reproduction number known as R or R0, and it estimates how likely the virus is going to be transmitted from person to person, and it takes into account, well, maybe the underestimating the number of people who are currently infected, and a whole bunch of other things, and this is a pretty extreme number of people. But although it sounds extreme, it's not clear how deadly the virus is. So the latest calculation of the fatality rate in a paper published on the 9th of February suggested there are about 1.4 deaths per 100 cases. So that's between 1 and 1.5%. But that number is probably too high, because the authors didn't consider less severe cases. In other words, the asymptomatic infections that really not really showing very much.
Right.
So although the numbers 500 million, 600 million people total sound extreme, the actual number of deaths probably
could be much less.
Much, much, much less.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess regardless of, I mean, it's good. Thank you for that and the information in terms of trying to see where we go from here.
Yeah.
As it continues and it's like you say, perhaps a smaller number is definitely better news, but the news of anybody being affected by this is still pretty devastating. So yeah, we keep listening, keep watching.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving on. Electric bacteria.
Yeah, this I saw this today actually, and I thought this was quite interesting. So so this is about generating electricity really from thin air, or maybe not so thin air, sort of humid air. Humid air.
Okay, thicker air.
So this is a new technology based on nanowire sprouting bacteria. So nanowires are little wires of proteins and biomolecules that are maybe a few billionths of a meter long, little tiny little rods or wires. And bacteria, these bacteria spontaneously sprout these growths, these nano-sized growths, and they are found to be able to generate electricity, and a sort of a remarkable amount. And the people, when you fashion these into a film, make these bacteria into a film, these little protein filaments, these wires, ferry the electrons away from the bacteria, and they can produce enough power to light an LED, little light-emitting diode. And it works, it seems, by absorbing humidity from the surrounding air.
Wow.
Which is cool, but they're not sure exactly how it works.
How it works.
Right? Okay. So it's got something to do with humidity, and probably something to do with water from the air diffusing through this layer of bacteria.
Wow.
So you have some sort
That's
of concentration
so cool.
gradient, but they don't exactly know how. So they found that 17 of these little film devices linked together can generate about 10 volts of potential, and that's enough to power your cell phone.
Wow.
Yeah.
For like a day, or like charging
well,
it
up. Well, that's what's interesting. So they're calling this hydrovoltaic devices.
It just continues to be powered.
And it can be recharged, which is really cool. I know.
Crazy.
Yeah, so it's still a bit of a mystery, but this has some precedent. So when water droplets interact with certain kinds of graphene is this really thin type of carbon, you can get an electric charge generated. And those electrons can move through material, and basically you can capture the electricity. But there's a lot of questions exactly how this happens. Why does the electric charge spontaneously go to these materials? Mm. So these people are basing some work on studies that were done more than 15 years ago, which discovered that a bacteria called Geobacter shuttles electrons from organic material to some metals, such as iron oxides or metal-based compounds. And since then, they've learned that a lot of other bacteria can do this and produce these little nanowires, so they can shuttle these electrons around. And this produces a small electric current. But it's been, over the years, researchers have tried to harness this, you know, to actually make energy, to capture electricity, but it's been really challenging. And then about 2 years ago, a University of Massachusetts grad student, noticed that sometimes he isolated the isolated nanowires spontaneously generated current. He told his PhD advisor, who was like, "Yeah, right. No, not a chance."
Oh no.
Yeah, and a bit skeptical to begin with, but they kept doing it, and they could reproduce it. And they found that when they sandwiched these little wires between two gold plates, they could get consistent power for about 20 hours.
Wow.
And what was really cool was the device could recharge itself. So it was, and the trick to do that was to make the top plate, the little top gold plate, a little bit smaller. So a little bit of the bacteria and the nanowires was exposed to the air.
Okay.
And what was happening, I think, that they figured out was it was absorbing some of the humidity, the water from the air.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I mean, what's the chances of kind of developing that technology on a larger scale?
Well, I mean, there's a few quotes in this article saying this is really quite a groundbreaking discovery here. And whether it's scalable, whether it's, reliable enough for
powering
our lives, powering this university,
radio station,
or this radio station. Yeah, it's not clear yet, but this is potentially a really cool invention. You know, you can walk around with these little films on you, and you could power your cell phone or power your whatever device that you can.
I guess, though, it would depend on the day and the weather.
Well, it depends on moisture. So they found that around about, I think it was 45% humidity levels were sort of optimum. But it would also work. So it's just the moisture. So it's sunny, cloudy, whatever. It's just, okay. It's just this humidity. But they found that it would work in conditions as dry as the Sahara or as humid as New Orleans.
Okay, that's so incredible.
Yeah.
Very exciting. All right. Our last story. Minke whales. I love whales, by the way. A little bit biased here.
So so we should get into it. So minke whales, they are struggling to communicate because the ocean is getting louder and louder. And I found a little clip. So the article said, imagine a frog call, but with a metallic twang and the intensity of a chainsaw. It's really difficult to imagine that. So I found a clip of a minke whale. So listen to this.
Okay, we're going to play.
Isn't that bizarre? Play it again. It's so cool.
It is. And so that's a whale making a noise.
Now, there's a few different calls. So there's more of a sort of a boing, boing call does as well. So there's a few different ones, but that was just the weirdest.
Or the coolest in their language,
or the coolest.
I guess.
Yeah, I don't know what it means in minke whale speak, but... so anyway, it's another study analyzing tens of thousands of minke whale boings. Scientists have found that the whales are losing their ability to communicate over long distances, which is a problem because whales need to communicate. It could limit their ability to find mates, engage in social contacts with other whales and things like that. So they looked at they measured using microphones, underwater microphones, they measured whale locations fairly accurately, so they could sort of hear and see where the whales were, and then they used those pinpoint locations to calculate the intensity of each boing, if you can call it that, and when it was emitted and things like that, and they compared the measurements with ambient noise, including waves and wind and undersea earthquakes and things like that. And they found, maybe not surprisingly, that minke whale boings grew louder in louder conditions. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. You know, when you're at a party, it's loud. You
have to yell.
You have to yell. And then the sound goes off and you feel like an idiot. And apparently that's called the Lombard effect. I didn't know this. It holds true for humans, you know, when you have to speak louder.
Yeah, okay.
But minke whales differ from other whales. So other whales get louder and louder. Orcas and humpbacks seem to compensate fully for increasing noise in the oceans.
Right.
The intensity grows and grows and grows in lockstep with the ambient noise levels. But minke whales increase a bit in the presence of loud noise, but not fully to compensate.
Right.
Okay. So they got certain up to a point, but then they didn't get any louder.
So would this mean that they just can't get that loud, or...
Yeah, well, this is apparently similar to some other animals. So bottlenose dolphins have been found to be the same, and some terrestrial animals such as bats and frogs have the same sort of response. So they get up to a certain point, but they don't get any louder.
Wow.
So because their calls are relatively quieter, first of all, population estimates of these whales are probably inaccurate because there's less sound that people can hear.
And so there would be more whales?
So they could be more whales. They're not endangered, but we don't know an awful lot about them because they're quite elusive.
Mm-hmm.
They keep themselves to themselves. But sound is important. It's the primary way that whales sense their environment. And when you've got a call like that, I mean, come on, play
like
it again.
Like how?
Like that.
So, okay, we're talking din of the ocean being too loud. This is, you know, is it fishing boats? Is it cruise ships? Is it anything? Is it other animals?
Yeah, so the ocean has been getting louder by about 3 decibels per decade, primarily because of commercial shipping.
Okay.
Right? Now, when there's no noise, or when there's just low noise levels, you can actually, minke whales can communicate over up to, I think it says 114 kilometers. So one minke whale can make this
noise.
Cool call and his mate can hear him 114 kilometers away.
Just at whole
but as
scale.
Noise levels, yeah, I know, as noise levels increase, that's gone down to 19 kilometers. So that's nearly an order of magnitude. That's a big, big drop. So, you know, when he's calling for his mate 100 kilometers away, he can't hear him
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
So that's sad.
So, I don't know, be quiet in the ocean?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you, Marcus. Thanks for the updates, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
We will.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.